Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning, everybody. It is Sunday at noon. This is a live edition of The Main Course. I'm your host, Patrick Martins. We're broadcasting live out of Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street. That's buzzing here. They have a New Yorker party, it seems like, and a lot of people running around preparing for that. I'm just back I took a red eye from Las Vegas, where we officially launched the month of Goat-tober. And we're really psyched. Three of Mario Batali's and Joe Bastianich's restaurants out in the Venetian Hotel in Las Vegas organized a series of goat dinners and tasting menus and menu items to help launch Goat-tober. So it was really spectacular and cool to see so much goat being served in Las Vegas. And the menu items were absolutely delicious. They have three restaurants. One's called B&B, stands for Batali and Bastianich. One is called Enoteca San Marco, which is really just like Otto restaurant, exactly, here in New York. And then they have one called Carne Vino, which is a kind of new breed of steakhouse where they literally handpick the best cows off the line are able to, get the ribeyes and strips off of those. So it is really one of the best steaks in the world, if not the best. And it was just really cool. We had a little miniature figurine of a goat, like a little Star Wars figure or something, but of a goat. And we would pose him in the most Vegas style, compromising positions. So you should log on to the Heritage Foods USA Twitter feed and Facebook account and see, a little goat, posing on the breasts of some of the most famous actors and actresses in the country. Also, posing on guitars of famous rock musicians. It is really fun. Some pictures are up, some pictures will go up tomorrow, but we're super excited about Goat-tober and the 35 to 40 restaurants that'll be serving goat on their menu every day of the week. So very, very exciting. Today's show is, a little bit of a, sad show, but also a show that, inspires people about a very inspiring life. A few weeks ago, as we had mentioned already on the main course, really Wallace Edwards Jr., they called him. I mean, his name was S. Wallace Edwards Jr., but everyone called him Wallace. He was 82 years old and, he passed away after 82 years. And, he is a guy who had really passed on a heritage of, great national culinary traditions for future generations. And, we wanted to honor him and also talk a little bit about, this country's past and what things might have been like back then, get a lens into that. It's hard. A lot of things do not last 82 years or 87 years in the case of S. Wallace Edwards and Sons Ham Curing Facility. So it'll be an interesting lens into American history. And we are joined by Wallace's son, Sam Edwards III. So, Sam, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. And thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, obviously on a personal level, I am interested to hear more about your dad and what things were like back in, the 30s and 40s. And I know he had basically been the cure master for over 50 years at your family business. So I think it'll be interesting for all our listeners just to understand what things might have been like back then. So I wanted to, first ask you. So he was born on December 13th, 1930, to Mr. and Mrs. S. Wallace Edwards Sr. of Surrey, Virginia. So when he was born, the ham company had already been going for about 3 or 4 years, right?
Right. My grandfather grew up on a farm and learned how to cure hams from his, actually probably more from his mother than his dad, because his dad died kind of young. But they had a smokehouse on the farm, and as he got older, one of his first jobs was, besides farming, was to be a ferryboat captain for his future father-in-law, who was Captain Jester. Captain Jester started the ferries between Jamestown, Virginia, and Surrey, Virginia. And anyway, my grandfather was hired on as a captain, and he started serving ham sandwiches on the ferry, which in the 1920s was about the time that Colonial Williamsburg started to get recognition as a tourist place to come and learn about history, Jamestown and Williamsburg, and we love the ham sandwiches, where can we buy the hams? So that's how the Edwards family got in the ham business. And then my dad, of course, grew up in it.
It was Captain Albert F. Jester, started by his maternal grandfather, basically, was this Scotland ferry tradition. So
right.
Who was it, though? His father, right? I mean, S. Wallace Edwards Sr. Was he the one that was like, hey, we've got to turn this little farming cure house outfit into a more legitimate business?
No, I think it was just a way to make extra money.
Uh-huh.
As a ferry boat captain. And again, he had brothers and sisters growing up on the farm, and of course this is a way to add to the family income. It was a wise move to step away from the farm a little bit, do some other things, and then it's funny how things turn out that way. But I don't think his goal was to become a ferry boat captain forever. He just kind of married into that part of the business, and the ham business became his what he hung his hat on for his life. Work. And then, of course, my dad grew up in the business. He was born into it. And when I say born into it, I mean, at that stage, we were curing the first year 55 hams.
Huh.
So when dad came along, they probably graduated into the maybe 5,000 pieces a year category. But we were doing bacon and sausage and typical country cure products selling to Crossroads Country Stores. And for us, Colonial Williamsburg has been the restaurants in that that region have been kind of where our growth has followed.
Now, were you a dime a dozen? I mean, were there dozens of guys, maybe not procuring in the exact same method, but were there dozens of other cure masters around Virginia and the South at that time?
Sure, in Virginia, dozens in Virginia, hundreds in the Southeast, and even you go up really all over, dry curing was kind of a common practice from the East Coast to the West Coast, because a lot of these techniques were developed before there was refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way of survival, which in turn led to livelihoods. I guess the key to the longevity of it is, and again, I can remember my grandfather teaching me these concepts, but my dad certainly reinforced them and constantly tried to keep the company's focus on healthy growth, but not at the cost of the quality of the product and the tradition that we had developed. There were faster, cheaper ways of doing it, but he felt like that wasn't the path to stay on. And as it turned out, we've sometimes, I think, due to stubbornness, have survive more so than intelligence.
What was it like back then? I mean, would he pre-sell these products, or would he just drive around in his vehicle? And cars were new back then, or, you know, I guess not that
sure.
new, but they would just drive around and be like, hey, it's been 2 weeks.
Yeah,
you ready?
Mondays Mondays and Tuesdays were sell days, and by Friday you had delivered hopefully everything that you had expected to sell. Mm-hmm. The difficulties then were because we didn't have huge coolers and freezers. You wanted to bring the product in, turn it really quickly, and get it back out by the end of the week. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can relate to that, too, being in the business you're in. But
I sell on Mondays and Tuesdays also, so that's funny.
Right. So, looking at it now, we have to forecast really right now in October of this year for what we expect to sell 2 and 3 years out.
Yeah.
Because we're aging hams, 18 months to 2 years, some in some cases 3 and 4 years. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty seat-of-your-pants kind of guessing, yeah. Really.
No security for sure. So when did S. Wallace Edwards & Sons become a livelihood for the entire family? I mean, was it even back in the 30s and 40s, for instance? Was it already, big enough that it was paying for things, or did you need supplemental income? Did other people have jobs?
Well, there were farming. Yeah, sure it was. In my grandfather's time, it was still farming along with the country ham curing and the ferry boat system.
Mm-hmm.
When my dad came along, he moved it from a really, really small 2 to 5 employee operation into a larger, say, 10 to 20 person operation, depending on it, the seasonality. But what the evolution that he brought forward was the involvement of the USDA into country ham curing, or not just country ham curing, but meat processing, during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and modernizing the facility, not to the point of losing any quality issues, but, trying to figure out what it is the government wanted us to do to ensure the product was safe.
He had no choice, right, in the matter. I mean, USDA, when did the USDA start to go to him and say, hey, there's got to be some uniformity, some rules that all of the cure masters follow? Right. When was that happening, and how did that happen?
It started in the 50s, mm-hmm. and it was a slow, methodical process because we started with state inspection and moved into USDA. Mm-hmm. But Dad was one of the first dry cured meat producers in the United States to figure out how to take the curing process from totally ambient conditions, which you were relying on Mother Nature to produce the times and temperatures, or not the times, but the temperatures and the humidities, versus a system where you could control the humidity and control the heat and the airflow so that you produced a more consistent product. And we're still tweaking that. We're still trying to figure out what is the best, especially in these longer cured hams, 18 months to 2 years, just the up and down humidities and temperatures that you typically find in Mother Nature, at the wrong times can be harmful, but at the right times is very, very beneficial. Mm-hmm. So we're figuring all of that out. A lot of it has to do with what I learned from my grandfather and father, and of course what we're still learning by trial and error today.
Sure. Now, what would your father say about those fascinating years of these protocols being developed by the USDA? Was it a sane process? Was it completely insane? Was it arbitrary? Were there great scientists behind the USDA when it started, or was it just a shit show of sorts, and you just have to follow the whims of your local inspector and do what he said?
Yes.
It's the second one, isn't it? It was a little crazy. It's still crazy, but
it was their attempt at, and we all understood the point and the purpose, but sometimes it became, I think even the government lost focus of what food safety was about and got more about command and control, which is today. I mean, literally, we had meat inspectors come in and say, well, I want you to paint this wall. The next inspector said, I don't want paint in my plant. I mean, we get them a new one every 6 months, so it was very arbitrary, capricious mm-hmm. and arbitrary is, I think, the term I like to use.
Capricious and arbitrary.
And depending on whether or not he was having a happy home life or not sometimes. But in the final analysis, though, the USDA finally came around the HACCP, which is, I think, a much stronger program where we work together to develop an effective food safety program, that you're not testing the plant as much as they used to, but you test the final product that goes out the door, which is really the proof that you're producing a safe product. Mm-hmm. Instead of meat inspectors, I call them plant inspectors. They weren't really in the good old days, they weren't inspecting the meat so much as they were inspecting the facility that that you produce the product in. Now, they're doing both with the proven steps in your process of producing the product that's safe to eat, and the way we prove that is by testing the finished product.
Hmm. Now, getting back to your dad a little bit, now, I know he did a few different things. I mean, he was in the Army, right, for a little bit in 1954, and he served in Panama and Maryland in the military police corps. Now, did he have a choice in the matter? I mean, did one have a choice in the matter to follow in the family business? Or, you know, when he was born into it, there was just like, go do your thing and then come back because this is a family business. I mean,
I think in Dad's case, I think he always knew that he was going to be in the ham business. It was, the draft was still into play at that point in time, so he said he wasn't drafted. He knew he was going to be drafted, so he signed up.
Uh-huh.
So, he got that out of the way, came back. And I've had uncles and cousins work in the business over the last 40 or 50 years, too. So it's not just my dad and myself. I've had an uncle and several cousins work in the business now. As a matter of fact, I have one of my first cousins still working with us.
I thought everyone was a first cousin down there.
Pretty much. Of course, my son's working in the business now, too. Mm-hmm. So my daughter's here this weekend, and she was talking about all the stuff that she's seen up where she lives happening in the restaurants, and is proud to see our stuff in the...
Yeah, it is really... Everywhere. I mean, Charleston was the last southern city I was at, and I mean, I was amazed at how many, you know, literally dozens of restaurants everywhere you look. So how would you define his management style? I mean, today you're, you know, one of the greatest ham curers in the American tradition or any tradition, you know, in America. What was his father's style? You know, what did he bring to the business? What did your father bring to the business? And what did you bring to the business? I mean, you know, almost like as presidents of this single company, what was each one's strong suit and management style and greatest accomplishments? You touched upon that
I think both my grandfather and father certainly were focused on quality because we're still a relatively small company, so mm-hmm. there were opportunities to grow faster with large grocery chains, but they just opted to say, "Well, look, we can't do that. We can't produce that much product and still maintain the quality level we're shooting for." Now, that's not to say we haven't grown. We have grown, but it's been at a much, much slower pace than a lot of other companies that were in the business and now are gone because they got caught up in, you know, he who produces it the cheapest wins. But in my opinion, it's, when I say cheapest, in other words, cuts corners,
mm-hmm.
because you can cut the cost of your product, which in turn cuts the quality, in my opinion. And, you know, they're no longer here. But then again, because each generation, it's tough. It's tough to go from generation to generation.
Yeah,
so what is it that all the generations have brought to the table? There's no question that the quality and staying true to the product. But at the same time, I think my grandfather and father did a much better job than I have. They were much more even-keeled Southern gentlemen. I mean, at my father's passing, the number of people that came to me and just told me over and over and over again, you know, your father and grandfather were true gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. And that's a word that came up a lot also in the things I read, honesty, integrity,
right,
service,
right,
quality, I mean, reputation, right, legacy, you know, things like that.
I have no excuse for my behavior because I've been taught the right way. The difficulty is in execution.
But the stakes are higher now. I mean, you're the Bill Clinton of the Edwards clan, right? You're the president of the internet. You launched the Mint mail order business, right? And it just seems like things were the toughest in your generation, this most recent one, because there's so much out there. Or is that not true? I mean, it just seems you have more balls to juggle and more stuff, social media to figure out, all of that.
Yeah, well, there's no question that that part of what's happening in how to sell and market your product. Fortunately for me, my son is in the business, and that's kind of his area of expertise right now. The thing that scares him the most about our business is the meat side that I grew up in. But he certainly gets the marketing and social media side of the business. And, you know, that's just the way it's going to be in the future, no doubt. So I feel fortunate that we've got him here to participate. And I'm glad that he knew his grandfather and what he stood for as far as product quality. I think over time, we'll continue to teach how we do the product, how we make the product to him.
Yes.
Just through osmosis, he picks it up. But at the same time, he's starting to get more and more interested in, you know, the history behind it and why it is the way it is.
Well, how did you learn that? I mean, tell us some of those moments. I mean, I've heard some funny stories about you being told to kill a bunch of pigs in a room, you know, and clean the bottom of the dirtiest pit, you know, and you really learned through the school of hard knocks. But what were some of those moments where things are passed between you and your dad, those magical moments that you remember to this day? How did they happen? What were those moments? And how does one pass on quality in a curing business?
Yeah. I mean, some of those stories I was just telling you just because I thought they were funny. They had nothing to do with instilling quality concept. But certainly work ethic was just, it was more of a necessity, you know, back in when I was growing up. It was like you were expected to, in a small rural community, the farmer's son gets on the tractor when he's, you know, 13 years old because he needs you in the field, not just to learn about farming, but to help get the crops planted and so forth. And it was the same way in our small business. The kids came along and they worked in the business to help provide the help need cheap labor, what could be said. But they started me off at very menial jobs. I guess maybe at the time I didn't know why, but it certainly gave me an appreciation for the guy that had to split the wood and clean out the grease pit and do the stuff that nobody else really wanted to do. So that part of it was certainly a benefit. But at the same time, I can remember my dad and grandfather carrying me into different aging rooms and go, tell me about what are you seeing and smelling and touching and so forth in here. And they would say, this room is the way you want it to look, taste, and smell. Mm-hmm. Versus, I rarely ever got the negative, meaning, you know, this is a bad, but it's more about this is the way it should smell. Or look, or the touch of the surface of the meat, or the color of the meat at this point in time. It was pretty clear when you didn't do it right, so there wasn't a whole lot of browbeating about this is not being done correctly. Let's just focus on what we're doing right, and eventually all of it will get better.
Now, how did your father help you after he was no longer president and you were running the company? I mean, was he important to you with little bits of advice on how to manage the team or figure out why a batch of bacon or hams hadn't come out exactly right? I mean, what was his role in his later years?
I think by the time we got to that stage, I pretty much had learned all of that. I think it really boiled down to I could call on him when it became time to focus on the bigger picture questions. Is it time? What do you think is going on in the economy? Do you think it's time to expand a little bit now? We've opened a couple of stores, and, you know, what do you think about this location? That kind of thing. But as far as the curing and nuances of it, I've been doing it. Dad retired in 95. You know, when I got out of college, I thought I knew everything, and it was time for him to move over.
When was this? You graduated college in what year?
78.
In 78.
Yeah, it was probably, I really wasn't sure I was going to do it full, really, until probably 82, 83. Mm-hmm. And then by 84, 85, I'm, okay, all right, I'm committed to this now. Let's see what happens. And, oh, by the way, you can go ahead and retire now because I'm ready.
But he waited another 10, 12 years, huh?
Oh, yeah. And of course, my mother had an impact, too, on how much time Dad should be spending and in the office and his, I don't want to say it was his unwillingness to let go. I think it was more he really enjoyed what he did.
Did you guys think?
Now looking at it, I go, okay, well, it wasn't so much he wasn't confident that the next generation could move forward. It was he enjoyed what he did, so why should I give it up?
Mm-hmm. Now, did he say, you're great, Sam, I love you, you're doing a fantastic job? I mean, was that part of the culture of a family business? Because he, you know, did it his way for 50 years and then hands it off. You know, did you guys have your moments to be proud of, you know, what you mean to American food traditions and stuff? Was he a gushy guy?
No, he wasn't a gushy
guy. Yeah, I didn't think so.
But at the same time, he did enough patting on the back so that you didn't feel like it was. I always felt like it was really sincere and he meant it because it wasn't like he said it all the time. And, you know, so whenever he did say it, it meant a lot. And, you know, even in recent weeks or months, he said it enough to make me feel good about what we accomplished as a family and as a group.
No,
it didn't happen every day. And yes, we did have the knockdown dragouts about, I think it's time to do this. And he would go, no, we've done it this way for 25 years. You know, why do it? Why? The catalog business and the stores and things like that were all things that, even though we dabbled in it a little bit, it wasn't something that he thought we should go into. But as it turned out, it worked out fine.
Yeah, well, that's a profitable side of the business for sure. So now tell me about this pressure. I mean, there's somewhat got to be a family pressure to continue the business on. And now that your father is passed, does it make you look at the life of the business in a different way or ask certain questions about the future of the business that you didn't ask before? I mean, it's a time of to look to the past and think about the future. I mean, is it, I don't know. I mean, can you speak to that a little bit, the responsibility of carrying on something that's existed for 87 years?
Well, you know, let's recognize what any business, and Edwards is no different. It's not me. It's not just family. We've been really fortunate to have employees, too, that contribute a lot to the success of the business. And whether the company continues on with an Edwards kind of calling the long-term shots and goals, creating the business plan every quarter, year, and five-year plan, there are others that are going to be just as good, if not better, if an Edwards family member doesn't stay in it. Our hope is that somehow or another we continue that generational story.
Yeah.
And, you know, if it works out, it works out. But, I hate to put – my dad told me, and my grandfather told me this, it's just a business. If you decide that you want to become a radio talk show host, mm-hmm. do it. What makes you happy?
Yeah.
And that's the key to the success of life. If you stop and mm-hmm. think that my grandfather grew up on a farm, had the opportunity to run, at the time it was ferry systems. They had multiple ferry systems up and down the James River and mail boats. And I mean, that was a whole viable another business that he could have mm-hmm. gone into. Every generation has to make up their mind as to what direction they're going into. It just makes it a little more difficult when you know it's been a multi-generation.
Yeah, so it's got to add something. Well, we'll unpack that question over time as you continue to come onto the station. Well, Wallace, leaves behind his loving wife of 59 years, Yvonne B. Edwards of Williamsburg, Virginia. He's also survived by his son, of course, who's on the show today, Samuel W. Edwards III, and his wife, Donna W. Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. Other survivors include his granddaughter, Stephanie A. Edwards, and her fiancé, Thomas R. Sutton, and grandson, Samuel W. Edwards IV, sister, Oneida Mae Johnson, his late daughter's husband, Paul Hart, and many nieces and nephews. Well, thank you, Sam, for doing what you do, and much respect and props to Samuel Wallace Edwards Jr., 82 years old, passed away a couple weeks ago. So he will be remembered, and yeah, we're big fans of everything that that family has done since the beginning of the last century. So thanks for being on and telling our listeners a little bit about his life.
Well, thank you for it's an honor to that you would take the time and the interest to listen to the story. Thanks.
All right. Well, we will take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk with Larry Bokel about trucking in the 1930s and 40s, and a look back at the history of moving product across this great country. Stay with us.
You're listening to Snickers by Obesity on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Well, we're back. I am Patrick Martins, the host of The Main Course. We just had a very interesting, history of a life. S. Wallace Edwards Jr., who just passed away at 82. He was the cure master of S. Wallace Edwards and Sons for over 50 years. He will be missed for sure. Anyway, it's very interesting to look back to the 1930s and hear about how things were. And now we have one of our favorite guests who generously gives us a few minutes on Sundays every few weeks, Larry Bokel from Cannonball Express. How's it going, Larry?
I'm doing great, thank you. How are you, Patrick?
Oh, very good. Well, thanks for your time. I know you have a family and you work hard at Cannonball Express all week, so we appreciate the time. And today we wanted to just talk to you a little bit, since we were looking back to the 30s for Sam's father and grandfather, just wondering if we could pick your brain about what the trucking industry was like back in the 1930s, and how did stuff get around, or 40s or 50s, before the trucking companies of today. What was it like back then?
Sure. Well, back in the earlier days, there was a lot of trucking that was done locally from hub to hub. They were more or less tractors that didn't have what we call sleeper berths, where you can actually live in a truck 7 days a week as we do today. A lot of our drivers are, that is their home is what they're driving. Back then, they ran more or less what you call day cabs, where the truck was basically a tractor where once you got done with your day, you would check into a motel or go home in order to spend your evening and your sleeper time. So the homes and the trucks are really become their 7 day a week getaway. Even though they work in their truck, they live in their trucks, and that's pretty much how my fleet operates with owner operators. And also back then in those days, there were truck stops galore because you didn't really have a sophisticated interstate system like you do today. So your distance traveled was pretty much a lot less total miles per day. So you had a lot of roadside cafes and roadside services where the truckers could stop and you'd get their laundry done and socialize and do things during your off time, where pretty much now it's high-speed interstate travel where you can basically drive for 11 hours straight, 660 miles, before you even take time off to do any of your non-trucking responsibilities.
Huh. Now, would they go, so they wouldn't go Kansas City to San Francisco. They would go Kansas City to maybe Boulder, or I mean to Denver or something, and then from Denver another trucker would take the whole trailer with him and they would drop it off like that?
That would be more of a correct statement. What you did back then was, if you were a buyer of products in California, you wouldn't necessarily shop in New Jersey. You would shop within a 500-mile radius. Huh. Because transportation was so sectional back then. Now it's coast to coast, because we can travel from the California coast to the Jersey coast in a matter of a day and a half with the interstate systems and the speeds of the trucks and mm-hmm. being able to sleep in your tractor and run with teams, which mm-hmm. was two drivers in each truck. So reaching the coast to coast is almost only a day and a half excursion. Back in those days, 500 miles was probably a two-day event. So you didn't really travel coast to coast back then as you do today.
And what were the trucks like? I mean, did they carry the same amount of weight and basically go the same amount of speed when there was an open stretch of Blue Highway or something like that? Or were these tinier trucks moving less product?
Yeah, there were smaller tractors and smaller trailers. Today we run what we call 53-102 trailers. They're 53 foot long and 102 inches wide. And between the truck and the trailer, you can run at 80,000 pound max. And back in those days, you had 40-foot trailers, 20-foot trailers. You never had a 53-foot trailer behind you until about the last 10 to 12 years. So capacity, the weights of the trailers allowed on state highways, and you're not traveling on single-lane roads anymore. So you can run up speeds up to 65 or 70, whatever the speed limit may be. Back in those days, 45 to 50 was pretty much maxed out. Single-lane highways, no passing zones. Mm-hmm. So it took a much more longer time to proceed across the distance you needed to travel in a day.
Right, even though by nature they were going through less distance. So were there just a lot of trucking companies? I mean, did every region just have like 50 trucking companies? Or, I mean, tell us about Cannonball Express or its equivalent back in 1930. What did that company look like? Who were the drivers? Were they full-time drivers? How did someone move product?
Well, basically, Cannonball Express, we're kind of like it was back in the old days. We're owner-operators, which means the owner drives the truck and he owns his truck and trailer. Back then, that's exactly what it was, the majority. Most trucks were owned by their drivers. They were local, 500-mile or less operators. They found their business freight from a manufacturer and made an agreement to take their freight from point A to point B. Now with the trucking industry, there's a lot of large carriers, nationwide carriers with 7 to 10,000 trucks, and the drivers are hired, they're employees, and the trucking company owns the truck, owns the trailer, tells the employee where to travel, when to get there, and what to do. So it's really become a large corporation, large trucking operations dominating the industry now, but luckily, I enjoy the operation we run being owner-operators because we're not in the majority yet. We're not a large trucking company that hires the drivers and owns the equipment. Our operation is more like the older days, like you suggested, where there's small one- or two-truck operations that are basically owned by the driver.
Hmm. And schedules, obviously, I mean, you guys are religious, rabbinical with your schedule. I mean, Thursdays, Fridays, things are picked up from around your region, brought to Omaha, and then gets anywhere in the country on Monday, Tuesday, sometimes Wednesday. It couldn't have been as reliable back then, right? I mean, you ordered something, it could come in 4 days, 6 days, 8 days, or, you know, it couldn't have been as sure, was it?
That's exactly right. You never knew what weather would bring, and you had slower moving equipment and less efficient highways. So the timetables were always jeopardized by a lot of different outside activities beyond the control of the truck. Pretty much now, you know ahead on what the weather's going to bring. You can prepare for it. You're running down two-lane interstate highways. If you want to maximize your distance, you run it hours after rush hours, run in the evenings and weekends when there's less traffic. So once you get an experienced driver, they know how long it's going to take to get from point A to point B. It's pretty much a given that you can meet your timetable week after week. And it's not really an issue about late trucks or trucks of freight not arriving on time.
So, my question is, was it the good old days back then, or it wasn't so good? And when did things start to change for the worse? Was it the, certain aspects of it? Was it the arrival of the interstate highway system, the loss of CB radio culture? I mean, what were some of the real huge headlines that changed it back from the blue highway days of people going regionally to, a situation now where Cannonball Express is one of the few owner-operated companies left?
Well, a lot of change, and I won't say they're for the worse, but a lot of changes now. We have regulations that are telling the drivers when they have to sleep. For instance, recently passed, they have to have the 34-hour restart I mentioned on other shows, where they have to be in their sleeper berth from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. two consecutive days. Never before July 1 of this year was there any rule when they could take their time off and when they had to sleep in the industry that they are dominant in. And it never used to be that you can only travel, drive 11 hours in a day, and that was it. So a lot of regulations have affected it, plus cost of equipment and inflation and rules about efficiency on trucks and trailers that have driven equipment prices up. And I have an owner-operator, and if a driver walks into my office today and asks to become an owner-operator to buy a truck and a refrigerated trailer, it's about $260,000.
Wow.
So it's very expensive nowadays for a driver to become an owner-operator. It's much more easier to knock on the door of a large carrier and say, I want to be a driver for you. And if they become employed with that company, they're put in a truck and a trailer that's owned by the company, and off they go. There's no investment. But their revenue earning potential is considerably different. My owner-operators live a wonderful life because the revenue of what we do, hauling pieces and parts, allows them to buy the best equipment and the most fuel-efficient trailers and trucks. And they continue to be very happy at what they do and prosperous and are very proud of the earnings that they have the opportunity to make. The changes in the industry, as I kind of mentioned, with running trucks now, they require diesel exhaust fuels, which is a costly additive to burning diesel. Mm-hmm. And trucks and trailers, they have to be more cognizant of the rules in states like California, where they require the age of the equipment to be less than 8 years. Hmm. A lot of meaningful changes that require an additional cost to an owner-operator, which basically is making the owner-operator industry smaller and smaller and going more and more to the big, larger fleets.
And as you said, in the last time you were on the show a few weeks ago, you don't have as many, like, for instance, wives or husbands, in the trailer with their family, because it's now a one-income situation, whereas in the past, people could pay for a family or a couple could live off of the salary of one trucker.
That's true, especially if you're an employee trucker. If you get paid by the mile, which if you're becoming hired and driver, you get so many cents per mile for every mile you travel. You're basically working to earn as much revenue as you can. It's hard to support a family on just a trucking salary. Now, owner-operators that run my fleet, they can support a family very comfortably, but they got to consistently be on the go and work real hard at it. But they can make a wonderful living and be very comfortable in life by being a trucker in either an owner-operator or an employee condition, but much more revenue lucrative if you're the owner-operator.
How many mile? How much does it cost a mile today, going rate? You know, hey, I got to drive 500 miles. What is a person going to pay for a trucker to drive 500 miles? Is it $2 a mile, $3 a mile?
I can speak because I run in refrigerated transport. Dry vans where you're not running expensive trailers and burning reefer fuel is another thing. But my drivers, basically, we invoice or charge approximately about $2.25 a mile to the shipper. So you figure if you're running 100 miles at $2.25, that's what it will cost you. But you got to understand they're shipping about 44,000 pounds of freight.
Yeah.
So the cost per pound is very minimal.
Well, very, very interesting. I mean, God, I could go on and on. I mean, I wrote a chapter in my book. It's most people's favorite chapter, talking about all the old trucker songs, about CB radio culture, about the new regulations. And today on Larry's probably 7th or 8th or 10th time on the network, told us a little bit about trucking in the 1930s and 40s before the interstate highway system. So thank you very much. And hey, if anyone ever needs anything trucked, Cannonball Express, if you're in the Midwest or near it, there's no better group. So thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so do we. And we are engineered by Joe Galarraga, and we are a membership-supported nonprofit organization, so consider becoming a $60 or $120 member and getting a big, beautiful tote bag. And I guess that's it. Joe, have I forgotten anything?
No. Good show.
Yeah, that was a good show. And Joe, I like the new look. Now that you're an established rock star touring the country, I like the new lumberjack look. I think it's good for you.
Thanks.
All right. Well, stay tuned for What Doesn't Kill You by Katie Kiefer, then The Mike and Judy Show with Mike Edison, and then finally The Morning After. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.